Tim Goldstein, autistic adult, and your host for Life in a Neurotypical Universe, where we take a look at life from the perspective of an autistic adult. Again, we have a unique episode of Life in the Neurotypical Universe. This is a monologue by me. Really, it's a recording of a class that I taught at the IRL School of Cornell University. Thought I'd record it and play it back to everybody because I thought it was a pretty good session. You should find down in the show notes the link to be able to get the PowerPoint slides that went along with it. And trust me, they're not boring. It's mostly a picture book. It's kind of fun to look at, to be honest with you. Please enjoy. I was mic'd directly, and we didn't have mics on any of the people who asked questions. I've tried to boost the volume as best I could from the mic that I was wearing and make it as clear as it can be. But please just bear with us that sometimes the questions are a little difficult to hear. We're going to dive in. First off, this is me. And I always knew I was a geek. That was back before it was even chic. You were just a geek. And fortunately, times changed, and now it's cool to be a geek, so life is good there. The other things that I bring to this that's a little different than some people you'll speak to is I actually have 15 years of non-tech business background. A lot of it was actually in the bicycle industry, where I started out from turning wrenches in the shops, working my way all the way through to eventually doing international supply chain and doing national sales teams, all those kind of things. I've been an entrepreneur, really funny. Dad wanted, I have three brothers, wanted all of us to have nice white-collar jobs and not have to work with our hands like he had to. So I went and opened a machine shop and ran that for 10 years. I enjoyed getting my hands dirty. It was kind of fun. And then I've spent 20 years working in the tech arena, and both as a technician, you know, hands-on doing work, and also as a manager in the IT department. I was actually CIO of a small IT department and managed in other arenas. Out of that, 15 years of that, I worked as a consultant. And as an independent consultant in the IT industry, the wonderful great advantage you get that most people don't get to have is you get to go into so many companies and check them out from the inside out and actually learn what they're about and how they all work. And my personal experience says every single company is a train wreck. Some have the engine fall off, some have the caboose fall off, some jackknife in the middle. The trick is find the one that just happens to suit your personality, but nothing's ever perfect. Definitely learned that going through the consulting thing. But there was also very interesting in just seeing how different companies interact and interface and deal with their employees and particularly their tech employees. And I want to back up a little bit and say, tech is not the only thing that autistic people do. I mean, there's all kinds of autistic people who do all kinds of things. We just happen to be focusing currently in our society on tech particularly, because it is very high-paying jobs, and there is a high population of these types of candidates that would fit very well into those jobs, or are already in those jobs and may not know that they're neurodiverse. I'm autistic. I have Asperger's, which actually doesn't exist as a condition anymore. We'll talk about that just a little bit. And I was not diagnosed until, about 6 years ago. I went through most of my career not knowing that I was autistic. All I knew was I did really well when I took on new stuff. I did really good at teaching myself things. I could generally be very successful, and I got fired a lot, which seems like kind of an odd combination if you think of, do well, be successful, all that, and then get fired. But what you'll actually find is that is not at all a unusual career path for somebody that is neurodiverse. Because if you manage to get into the company, the game isn't done. You got to stay in the company. And one thing that myself personally and a lot of autistic people in general, were really good in short-term relationships. So in other words, sit down, meet you, Lucien, for lunch, and we have a conversation. We can have a great time, walk away thinking that each other is just a wonderful person. But if we had to work with each other for a month and a half, we may come to a little bit different conclusion over that month and a half than in that short time. And that's where staying employed is one of the big, huge challenges. It's not just getting employed. Being fired set my path to a certain extent. Now, I will say, not every time I changed jobs was it because I got fired. But I probably did get fired more than most of you people are going to have jobs in your career, probably. And the other part was because I did work as an independent consultant that I was interviewing for lots and lots and lots of jobs. When you combine the getting fired, so you got to go out and find a new job, with the fact that I was a consultant and did short-term projects, I was also looking for lots of jobs frequently. And I got pretty good at interviewing. I went at one point where I managed to go 14 interviews in a row and got the job offer. So I think that's, you know, that's pretty decent. The other thing, though, that was going on at the same time was when I'd gotten diagnosed as having autism, my wife and I were actually going to a bunch of different seminars to learn how to take our knowledge and what we know and package it in a way that it can become valuable information to help other people. Well, with a background in small business and big business and import and export, you know, web development, all those things, I knew I had things I could teach people. I just didn't know what I wanted to teach them. So I started going to the classes, you know, like all of you are going to classes, to start learning those skills, even though I didn't know the exact direction I was going to head with it. Well, it all came together and turned into the book that Suzanne had mentioned of Geek Guide Interviews. Well, if you're going to classes that are teaching you how to make your knowledge into information, sooner or later, you got to produce something. And that's what I decided to produce because A, I had a lot of experience in interviewing. B, I knew from all my years working in the tech arena that there was an awful lot of us neurodiverse, or what I'll often call functionally autistic. And when I say functionally autistic, what I'm talking about would be somebody that if you were to put them next to me, you probably wouldn't figure out which one of us is autistic or which one isn't. We'd be about the same. But if we were to go to the doctor and actually get, you know, a diagnosis, maybe they're missing one checkbox. For all intents and purposes, yes, they really, you know, act as if they are somebody who is neurodiverse. From being in that arena all that time, I knew that I worked with a lot of neurodiverse people. And in chatting with them, I knew they had problems with interviews that I had somehow managed to figure out ways to get around, because they weren't getting, you know, 14 out of 14. They were getting 1 out of 10. You know, not great batting averages when there's so many tech jobs that you can't even delete the emails fast enough. All that came together, ended up writing the book, Geek's Guide to Interviews. What makes it unique is it's written from the perspective of somebody who is neurodiverse to people who are neurodiverse. So it's explaining it in the way that a neurodiverse autistic person can understand. And that's going to be one of the big points that I'm going to be bringing up as we go through this, is the difference in thinking patterns, the difference in ways that neurotypicals think compared to neurodiverse people think. There's a huge difference in the perception, the processing, the thought patterns. And that's just going to keep coming up as we go through this. Well, how is it that we always used to study autism? Autism, right, most of us knew was what we've heard of it. It was a childhood disease, right? Until the 90s, that's all it was known as. It was a childhood disease. And the way that we used to study it is we'd study it like this, because, you know, if you got a 3 or 4 year old, what can you do but observe them and try and figure out what's going on? You know, 3-year-old isn't going to tell you a lot about the cognitive activity going on in their brain. Unfortunately, now we've recognized that that autistic chicken, the child, is going to become an autistic adult, chicken. Big difference. We're still doing it often a lot by observing the chicken. But guess what? We have adults now. We can just ask the chicken what's going on in their brain and understand why they went over and went to the other side of the road. So the question is, why did the chicken cross to the other side of the road? Oh, come on, somebody's got to want to answer that one. Well, the answer, yeah, okay.
Did he get to the other side?
No, that's what everybody thinks. And you fell for it. No, don't you know that there's some gorgeous flowers growing over there that are exactly what his wife wants? And he's going to get the flowers to take them home. Right? But can you see how that is a very much different way of thinking about it? If you observe, you see the chicken run across, and the thought is the chicken wants to cross the road, right? Because that's all you got to see. What you didn't see was what the chicken did afterwards, which was grab some flowers and take them home. Big difference between crossing the road just to cross a road and crossing the road to go get flowers for your favorite. So big problem that we've had is this has been the model that we have around autism and neurodiversity. It's been all built by observation, standing on the outside, looking in, trying to figure out why do these people act and do the way that they act and do things. Unfortunately, you can't intuit people's intent. Now, you can certainly understand that across the road, you know, that's easy enough to document, but you can't intuit the why part. You've got to ask them, why did you cross the road? Oh, those flowers, my wife likes that kind. There you go. Very different answer. So terms, just to kind of pull some things together here. There was a condition that was referred to as autism. And there was another condition that was referred to as Asperger's. And I don't know if we've really gotten into any of the history of it or whatever, but for the most part, Asperger's came from Germany and deals with what we would call, under some terms, high functioning. So Asperger always referred, he was a pediatrician, and referred to his kids as little professors. So think about that little kid that just knows everything about whether it's bugs or dinosaurs or whatever. That's the kind of thought that he would defined as being this symptom called Asperger's. Then the other type of autism actually came from the USA. And there's an interesting, great story. There were two doctors, they were battling it out. One had one theory that it was moms went to work, and because you went to work, you were so cold that you caused your children to have autism. It's called the refrigerator mother theory. It lost, fortunately. The one that won was the theory that basically said autism is nonverbal children. So now, up to early 90s, all we know is nonverbal children, and there's somebody over in Europe that doesn't have papers written in English that said something about these like really bright verbal children. And that was the whole sum of what autism used to be known as. Now, we know it as something much bigger, and the medical community has embraced that concept that those two pieces didn't cover the whole range. And what they've done is they took what was called autism and what was called Asperger's, and they've put it together into this thing that they call autism spectrum disorder. And autism spectrum disorder, there's some people that will say it's a plus and some people will say it's a minus. And the reason is, when you say autism spectrum disorder, what are you really saying? You know, that's about like saying somebody's heavy or somebody's light. Well, compared to what? I mean, there's no reference point, so it doesn't give you a whole lot. As you move along into ASD, we start adding in, there's where Asperger's would kind of sit if Asperger's was still considered a definition. And there's another term that's called HFA, which is high functioning autism. It's kind of falling out of popularity, but it was almost the American response to Asperger's because we didn't want to associate with Nazi Germany. So you'll see those two terms floating around. But what was interesting is when they combined all this together into ASD, you know, autism spectrum disorder, we essentially threw away the term autism and we threw away the term Asperger's. And we threw away the term HFA, and we just called them all autism spectrum disorder. So in other words, it's a whole wide range that used to be considered individual different things. But what they decided was, chances are, these are some similar things that express very similar to each other, even though they may have different causes. And there was a reason that they did that. And this has happened in the DSM-5, which that's the manual that your shrink uses to figure out what you got, or your therapist. And in the DSM-5 is where they put all this together. And one of the lines of thinking was, they didn't want to start getting into the realm like cancer is, where you divide it up into it's breast cancer, it's colon cancer, it's, you know, on and on and on, and all these cancers, and you give to all these different societies. They wanted it as one thing so people would focus on it and actually work on it, which is why part of the reason they just put it all under ASD was to bring the single focus to it and not turn it into such a divided group that essentially they're bickering amongst each other. What those things all lead us into is this concept of neurodiversity. And the concept of neurodiversity is super, super simple. Does everybody agree that you know, eye color can vary from person to person? Yeah. No disagreements. Smart group. How about your brains? Can the way your brains are wired and shaped differ from person to person, right? Most complex organ in our body. So it seems if our eyes can vary, our brains should be able to vary too. Well, there's a thought that says that the way that your brain is wired and configured is going to basically create the base level of how you interact and process with the world. So in other words, neurodiversity is basically saying normal human genetic variation is going to give us a whole range of people that think and process and perceive the world in different manners, and that's normal. And that's what neurodiversity is. It's saying that those differences all fall within the normal range of being human, as opposed to in the past where we would divide it up and say, oh, this is diseases, and oh, well, these people here, they're okay. No, we're really just saying neurodiversity, all humans fit under neurodiversity. No better, no worse, just different. That's all. This is what I refer to as my cloud concept of neurodiversity. And this is just kind of a way to try and picture it in your head, because it's a confusing concept. If you take a look at this cloud up here, you can see the cloud's got all different kinds of little pieces of confetti and glitter, we'll call them, floating around inside the cloud. And let's say that each one of those pieces of confetti and glitter represents a way that a person can perceive and process the world. Well, if we just take and mix them all up and then try and do some grouping, we're going to end up with this one large group, the one in green there, and we're just going to call that neurotypical. Not that it's special, not that it's unique, it's just that it's a group that tends to act and, you know, perceive and process and such in a similar manner. That's not saying they're identical, but that's saying that, you know, maybe they all like the same kinds of TV shows, that kind of stuff. I mean, there's a lot of similarity in there. When you step outside of neurotypical, you step into the world of what we refer to as neurodiverse. And neurodiverse doesn't mean anything except not in the neurotypical range. In other words, they think and process a little bit differently. I'm sure you've run all into all of this. Have you ever had to go deal with somebody who is like a real computer tech geek person if you're not a computer tech geek person? Yes? Yeah, we got plenty of yeses. And how well did the conversation and interactions go? not good, huh? Right. I mean, it's kind of like you're talking, one's here and one's here, and you just can never quite get where they come together and you understand what they're saying and they understand what you're trying to say. Exactly. That is just like the classic example of neurodiverse to neurotypical. And it's not saying they have to be a computer person. You know, what's kind of cool here at this campus is as we're going around it, you've got plenty of different schools inside this campus that are havens for people who are neurodiverse. you have an engineering school. You know, lots of engineers fall under neurodiverse. You know, a lot of medical people fall under neurodiverse, which probably means veterinarian falls under the medical that probably falls under neurodiverse also. And there's other, you know, departments you have. And, you know, there's engineering, there's architecture. Those are all very prevalent neurodiverse attracting industries. And when you think about it, there's a reason why. The basis of how those particular things work is all very solid logic basis. It's logical building blocks it's built on. It's not built on like HR is built or management is built, which is built on a much more flexible framework. There's not these set in stone ways that things have to be done. There's ways that they're suggested, and then you got to figure out kind of what's going to fit. Whereas when you go to the engineering world says if it's beyond, you know, the stress level, it's going to break. Period. So tends to attract different kinds of minds because of that. The big thing to remember when you're looking at neurodiverse versus neurotypical in this neurocode model is, first off, as you can see, there's no rigid boundaries between any of those things. You know, there's some lines drawn around there just showing some groupings, but they're not boundaries. They don't mean that things can't move out of the boundary. And it's also showing you that you could take somebody who, you know, like sits around here. Well, they're going to have some neurodiverse traits. They're going to have some neurotypical traits. They're going to have a little bit of mix of both. So the wonderful thing about this particular model compared to what you're often presented is this is really showing we're not talking about autism traits. We're not talking about OCD traits. We're not talking about anxiety traits or any of the other things that fall under neurodiversity. We're talking about human traits that all humans have. It just might be that these humans may have a little less problem with social challenge than these humans do. But on the other hand, how many of us have met people that we would all say are just normal, neurotypical, regular people, and they're just not comfortable, they're shy, they're not really good with other people, right? We've all met them. Does that make them autistic? Not whatsoever. But it does prove that having social interaction challenges is not an autistic trait, it's a human trait. But if you put enough of these human traits together, we get this thing that we end up calling ASD, you know, autism for generic name. So that's one thing out of it is, remember, you can mix pieces together. It's not quite as clear cut as it's neurotypical and it's neurodiverse. There's a whole smearing and smattering in between them. And the reason I created this particular model is the normal way that you would hear neurodiversity and particularly autism talked about is in this concept of low functioning and high functioning. So anybody out there want to tell me, what does high functioning in autism mean? I saw a shake in your head, yes. You're you know, sorry. Yeah.
I think high functioning is like when you don't have as many social problems or as many like things you can see, symptoms that you can see, and people who can just like function within society. And then low functioning is people who can't function within society as well.
So I'm going to ask you a question. I'm going to put you on the spot. Okay. Last year, maybe it was 2 years ago now. It was last year. I got hired to 3 6-figure jobs. And I got fired from 2 of them. Yeah. Am I high functioning or low functioning? Most people get fired from 6-figure jobs every, you know, twice a year.
Yeah.
That's pretty low functioning. So you see what I'm saying about that high-low functioning thing of how confusing it can be? I mean, generically, yes, you're 100% right in that kind of rough idea of high means better able to mix in interaction, low meaning less able. I personally don't really like that because it doesn't represent the real world. Autism is really a multivariant thing. When you think about all the different symptoms that are associated with autism, even if we just stick to the ones that are in the DSM, there is a whole range of symptoms, and you can have any mix or any combination of those symptoms and still end up with autism. So it is very complex, and for any particular person, high functioning for one person may be a completely different look than high functioning for another person. And then when you go into the low functioning, does low functioning mean that they could hold a job at a car wash, or does low functioning mean they need full-time daily care? So again, this high-low functioning model, That's what this is trying to destroy, because it does, the high-low functioning model does a disservice to the people that you're applying those labels to. Because to say they're low functioning, well, you know, at one time they said Einstein was low functioning, but he seemed pretty good in math. So talking about, the thing on that, the going back one then, the neurocloud thing, just remember, the further apart you are in that neurocloud, the more difficult communication becomes, because you're getting further apart in the ways you perceive and process the world. So that's really the big takeaway from that last one was, A, it isn't really a scale of high to low, it's this multivariate mixed up thing. You can have any combination of any of the symptoms, because they're only human symptoms anyways. And the further apart you are in the way you perceive and process the world, which is just like any diversity, the further apart from the groups you come from, the harder it is to understand and relate to that opposite group. Coming into this one, just to give you a little idea, how different can people perceive and process that are neurotypical versus neurodiverse? And I'm going to use an example out of my own life and with my wife. I, like a lot of autistic people, not all, but it's not uncommon, tend to eat the same thing about a year and a half, 2 years in a row. So whatever I have for lunch, about a year and a half, 2 years, I'm good for the same lunch. Which, by the way, happens to be a trait amongst many, very many, very high-performing people. It's a trait that actually Obama used to do that. And there's a number of other high, you know, type executives. And they just say, hey, it cuts down on my cognitive workload. I don't have to think about lunch. I just eat what they give me. Move on. Anyway, I was on a kick that was roast beef sandwiches on potato bread. My wife and I would go shopping. We'd walk into the store and we'd get in the bread aisle. And I'd be going up and down the aisle looking, trying to read the labels to find my favorite potato bread. Because heaven forbid if I don't get my favorite potato bread. And inevitably, my wife would just look over and go, oh, honey, it's right over there. And I'd walk over, pick it up, put it in the cart. Year and a half later, okay, I am a guy. I couldn't ask right up front. And I finally ask her, what is it that you do that you're able to just walk into the aisle and just point right at it? And she said, oh, it's really simple. I just look for that orange circle that's on the end of the bread label. I've been reading the letters on these stupid packages for a year and a half, trying to read the letter for the right brand with potato on it. She just looks for an orange one and goes, it's that one. I mean, how much different can you get in ways to perceive the world? I mean, you can see that was just in perception. That wasn't even in thinking about it and processing it. To her, color was the first things that hit her, and she identified by color. I, on the other hand, tend to be much stronger on the language side. So it's the languages that impacted me. I'm not color blind. I like to call it as color agnostic. When she pointed out it was orange, I clearly couldn't see the orange, but I never noticed it was orange until somebody pointed it out. And that's why I say I'm not color blind, but I just don't really pay attention to them. So you can see a big, big difference in thought pattern there. So now here's the question. When you look at this picture, how many people see only one thing? Raise your hands. Okay, yeah, some. How many people see two things? Okay, we got a bunch of twos. Okay, and so we basically have three possibilities then out of this thing. There's people who see one thing, and there's people who see two things, which means that the people that see one thing could possibly see either of the two things. So, right, three possible combinations out of the deal. Well, what we're looking at, if you look real closely, is that's a frog sitting right there. And this is a horse sitting right here. So the two people were right. The ones you missed one or the other. But the important thing about this was, is everybody in the room looking at the exact same information? Yep. Then how come we came up with three different answers? Right? Does that make any sense? We could have the same candidate sitting in front of us and come up with three totally different answers that have nothing to do with each other. Because perception is controlled by your own brain. Perception isn't controlled by what's going on out there. It's what comes in through that makes a difference. So if that doesn't convince you that you could sit in a room with somebody that sees the world completely different from you and not notice it, I don't know what will convince you. Well, I'm going to ask, anybody have any questions at this point? I mean, that's kind of the fun part of being here in person is, you know, actually talk with you and ask questions and have fun stuff. So before we kind of jump into a little another area here, anything that we talked about or questions you want to know about? And it's kind of free open reign. You don't have to pretend like this is the professor standing up front. I'll answer just about anything. So, you know, if you want to ask about your professor, I'll tell you what I can. But so, yes.
My question was, what were the struggles that you had on the job that didn't allow for your managers to see that you were different from them?
I would phrase that a different way for you. And the way I would phrase it would be, what was it going on with the managers that didn't allow them to see I wasn't the same as everybody else? Because I was being me. I mean, I was just being me, who I am. I mean, I haven't changed who I am. I haven't changed how I am much of any. The difference is when I'm in a group that is neurodiverse and autistic aware, it's completely different than being in a group, normal society, that when you say autism, what's the first thing that comes to most people's mind? Child, right? Boy, white, right? And the reason is that's the number one diagnosis, white males. You know, for some reason, people of color are always diagnosed later, women even later. It's some of those things that we need to figure out. It's not right, but it's the way it is. But the big thing is, no, it was nothing I was doing. It was that they couldn't see the difference between me and somebody else and assign it to something that they could, that they understood. Instead, they assigned it to Tim has a bad attitude. Tim can't get along with other people. Tim is bossy. Tim is black and white and hard-headed. I think if you lead down to the autism list, I think I hit just about four or five of, you know, about 10 of them. So in other words, Tim was autistic, but nobody knew that. But nonetheless, that's what I was displaying. I was just really displaying normal autistic things. But they weren't able to interpret why is it that I wasn't able to, we'll say in a social situation, or not social, a meeting. You got a boss, you know, some managers, some coworkers. Most people would essentially be talking to the boss in that meeting. No, I talk to whoever's important, and the boss, if he had something that was important, great. If he didn't have something important, well, he doesn't know anything. So what? Let's move on. Didn't go over well on the social side. Now, from the technical side, super effective, moves real fast. So it's one of those funny things of they didn't recognize it, but it made their things work better, but it wasn't the same as everybody else, so it wasn't comfortable. Does that answer it?
Perfect.
Cool. Shit.
What, like when they let you go, what were their reasons or like how did they tell you?
Oh, it's the perfect ultimate we're not telling you anything answer. You're not a good fit. In other words, they told you nothing. It came down to we're firing you and we don't want to put a reason down that you can actually sue us for. So we're just going to say you don't fit.
Oh, so was it like off the at will clause? Is that what it was, or like just?
Yeah. I mean, Colorado's an at will state, and so yeah, it's just, you know, that's the wondrous thing we have in America in our at will, employment method is, the company I work with currently, if we want to let go a UK employee, you've got to keep them on the payroll for 3 months, let them know, keep paying them, let them search for a job. In America, they hand you your box and say, get out the door. You know, it's the way it works. Yes?
Did your diagnosis change the way you approached the career search or your behavior in the workplace?
No, it really didn't. And I would say the reason it didn't was because of what I had been doing as a consultant, where I had been interviewing extensively and was pretty, you know, darn successful at it already. I really didn't change anything. If anything, there's only one thing I changed, and it should have been a negative, to be honest. And that is, as I've become more involved with autism, I've become, you know, quite active as an advocate. And if you just type my name into to Google, you're going to find out that Tim's autistic, you know, before you get off the first page. Matter of fact, every entry on the first page will tell you Tim's autistic. So, you know, I tend to disclose up front just because I'm so publicly visible about it. So I'd rather control it than let it be, you know, found out where I have no control over positioning it and such. So that's the only thing that really changed with it. On the other hand, if I didn't have those interviewing skills that I already had, and again, this is just pure luck. I mean, this was roll of the genetic dice, roll of the family you got with, roll of the schools you happen to go to. I mean, truthfully. And fortunately, I am not impacted in this ability to have, you know, one-on-one real-time conversations. But I'm sure some of you who have been around autistic, neurodiverse people, there's some who, when you say something, they have to stop and process for a little bit before they can give you the answer. And when they give you the answer, they give you like a phenomenal answer, but they can't just, you know, nail it on the spot. There's like a lot of silence in there before they get to it. So fortunately, I didn't have any of those challenges to overcome. Thinking about it, if I didn't take the exact path I did, I found out that I was, you know, autistic, I probably personally would still divulge just because it's become so much of my identity. And we had a great conversation with a gentleman at lunch, and he's disabled in a wheelchair, and I'm disabled in, you know, a cognitive issue. And we were talking about people first versus identity first language. And I think when you're dealing with cognitive issues, the identity first language is the right one. Personal, you know, take. And that's because everything that comes into this brain and how it's processed in here came through an autistic sensory system. I can't separate that out from me. So to me, that makes me an autistic person because it's an integral part of me, just like I'm a male person. I mean, I can't change what the genes are, you know? I mean, I can change how I want to express and have you all see it, but still, you know, the genes say male.
That's a good question. Thank you.
Okay, we got you covered. Cool. Anybody else?
I was just wondering, like, you said how, like, in tech and stuff, how, like, you feel like that's the best way that most autistic people can express themselves these days. I was wondering if you think that at some point, like on the spectrum, they'll be better off being able to express themselves in like liberal arts or like in artistic field as well. Like, do you think that'll happen?
Well, the funny part is, I think that if anything, the artistic world's probably doing a better job than we are, to be honest with you. The thing is that for some reason in the work world, the business world, we've concentrated on tech. And, you know, as your professor can tell you, she's been to plenty of the talks, all the groups will tell you while they were concentrating on tech, they've put people into the marketing department, they've put people into senior management, they've put people into, I mean, all different departments all over, even though the focus was on tech. The reality is I see autism as having two very different styles of expression. And one style of expression is that, like the one I have, the geek style of expression. You know, we live on the logic side of our brain. We don't do a lot of emotion. You know, we're geeky. Fortunately, my wife taught me how to dress, or I dress geeky too. That's only one side though, but that's the side we keep talking about. The side that we never talk about is, Robin Williams, autistic. Seinfeld, autistic. Daryl Hannah, actress, autistic. Who's the woman that from the UK that went on the UK whatever show? Susan Boyle, autistic. So you can go down the list of artists, and it doesn't matter whether, Eminem, if you want to go into music, Eminem's autistic also. Funny story on that one, but that's for another time in another place. but there are a huge amount of autistic people there. And there, I think they actually have more chance because the way that you're interviewed in those kind of positions is the way that you should be interviewed in corporate kind of conditions. What do we do with them? We audition them. We don't ask them to tell us how good their acting is or how good their singing is. We want to hear it. Like, come on, let me see and show you what you got. Is that, that hit it for you? Okay, cool. Yeah.
You had mentioned that now, because you're very physically, like publicly visible, you always disclose when you have a job. How has your interactions or experiences in your jobs once you get in the door changed from before you disclosed to after?
I guess the biggest thing would be after, and because I don't work at one of the companies that has an autism at work program in place. So I'm working at the vast majority of American corporations that, yes, have a diversity program, but it focuses totally on, you know, the normal traditional diversity things. And actually, it used to be your head of diversity here at Cornell that is now the head of diversity for the company I work for. Wonderful, wonderful guy.
So for instance, you mentioned a story before that when you're in a meeting room and there were social expectations about speaking to a boss first.
Right.
There's hierarchical social expectations there. But you necessarily didn't subscribe to those or behave in that way. And that would probably, I'm hypothesizing, would pose a bigger threat if people didn't know you were autistic versus if they knew that and could provide more understanding or be trained in some way.
I wish I could say I agree with you 100%, but I only agree with you about 50% now. And the reason I say that is I think that your generation has a much better feel for autism and what autism is and what neurodiversity is because you grew up in school systems that were treating it and diagnosing it so that it was known. So there's a lot less pressure about it. And when you do say something, you all at least, you know, generally have, there's a friend you went to school with, there's a family member, there's a cousin, there's a some relationship. That makes it easier if you can connect into that relationship to get them to kind of see you're a little different than what they have to deal with. And then it comes down to, I have to educate the hell out of them. Same stuff that you got handed out and stuff, I teach my bosses. I sit my bosses down and I train them. I wouldn't recommend everybody do it, but I do it. And I've also participated in the company on neurodiversity seminar, you know, panels, things like that, that Cornell put together. Does that cover it for you?
Yeah,
good. And then I'm going to jump back in after this one.
Do you think the growing prevalence of autism specifically in our country will further structural issues in organization, or will it shed light on change in terms of like people with ASDs?
I'm only thinking of how I want to answer that one. I have some doubts about a growing incidence of autism. And the reason I say that is I've been in the tech industry 20 years. So I was in the tech industry before anybody was talking about autism. You know what? There's the same number of adults with autism sitting in the tech industry now as there was 20 years ago. Hasn't changed, hasn't gone up. There's been a whole junior generation that's come through, didn't increase it a single bit. The only thing that's increased is the number of people that know they're autistic. That's the only thing that's actually changed. They were always dealing with it. If you go talk to an HR person at most companies that have over a couple hundred people and ask them who's their biggest problem children, it's going to be the engineers, the tech department. They just live in their offices. The problem is they don't know what they're dealing with. All they know is they're dealing with Tim just like can be an asshole. Yeah, I can be. But that's all they get. They don't know that it's autism they're dealing with. What went on? What was the reaction? Why did I have a meltdown that I acted that way? All they know is we have a problem to deal with this person. That's why I say I don't think it's increasing, to tell you the truth. But what's going on that is so phenomenal is the awareness is increasing. I mean, first off, it's a whole generation, you know, of you people. I'm looking forward to you people getting out in the world and helping change some stuff because you grew up in a different environment where neurodiversity was accepted. It was normal. It was just kids that you went to school with. I mean, they were no different than anybody else. So I think that's where the change is. The change is going to be in the awareness of the prevalence, not that there is more that's going to change the prevalence. We're suddenly going to recognize what I refer to as that functionally autistic. yeah, you may not score on the doctor's test, but on the other hand, I got to deal with you like an autistic person. That's how you think. That's how you process. I just mean we're going to find that there's a larger population of that out there than we're recognizing now. And we've just happened to notice them as kids. So we picked them up and said, autism, let's just start working on them now. Okay, jumping back into this part, just to give you some more things to ask questions about. Based on that NeuroCloud concept, I went and created some way to try and make that useful. Because, I mean, it's really cool to show a picture of a cloud up there, and it's kind of fun, and it gives you a great idea of getting away from that, you know, low to high continuum. But it's hard to, functionally do much with it. So what I came up with was what I call the NeuroCloud survey. And what it was based on is there was a study that was done, and the study was comparing 42 different models of autism to see which one was most accurate in predicting autism. And out of the 42 different models, the one that came to be the most accurate was pretty close to this one here, amusing, with the exception that they did take one factor and they cross-applied it to two different categories. Other than that, I didn't do that. But they were trying to achieve a different goal than I was trying to achieve. Their goal was, how can we diagnose somebody? My goal out of this is, I just want to surface where are your strengths and where are your weaknesses on an interactional basis. I mean, I don't care about these hidden things that nobody's going to see about. I want to know about these things that are going to come up if we sit down in a room and, start dealing together. What kind of things am I going to be dealing with? So I came up with that. And the way it ends up turning out is you end up with these three different radar charts. Those are mine. So, now you can learn all about me. And I break them into three different areas. There's traits, there's communication, there's social. And as you can see, if we take a look up in the traits one, the more blue you see, the more struggle the area is. And the less blue you see, the less struggle that area is. And I know they're hard to read, but difficulty with, I can't even read them. At any rate, I can certainly get you the list if you want, but what you can see is, on every one of these, with the exception of this one, I have some super, super high values, lots and lots of blue. It's a huge struggle for me. On the other hand, I have lots of places that have very, very little, blue showing, which is why I can stand up in front of you and talk to you, as a normal person would talk to you. Because, heck, I am a normal person. I just happen to have autism. The idea with this is a way that you can get a picture of somebody's interactional style and method and where they're going to be strong and where they're going to be weak. I mean, if out of this you pick up something that says, this one says appears arrogant, by the way, and I kind of come out of ways on that one. But if we take appears arrogant and you put somebody out to here and appears arrogant, I probably wouldn't send them for a sales job. It's just probably not the thing to do. So by using this, you can actually align where somebody's skills and strengths are to what the interactional requirements of that position are. And that's the real trick in trying to get somebody who is autistic to be successful is match their strengths to the job you want them to do and don't ask them to do things that they're not strong in. Huh, kind of funny. It works that way for all of us, doesn't it? One thing that causes problems all the time when you're communicating with people who are neurodiverse is, believe it or not, communication has three channels. And a lot of you don't think about three channels because nobody teaches it this way. We're not taught this in English class. You've got to go out and take advanced communication classes and start learning this stuff. If we're going from somebody who is neurotypical, when a neurotypical is talking, there's words coming out, obviously. But there's also tone of voice. There's a melody, there's a tone of voice, there's a sound coming out. And there are, facial body expressions coming out. But what happens is the majority of us on the spectrum can't process the tonals, can't process the body language, and all we get is the words come through. So we take the words, we unpack them as the dictionary says the first, meaning is, and we take it at face value of what you said. So if what your boss did was looked at you and said, like this is really important because it's for the big boss and gives you the wink like, right. I totally miss it. I'd like jump on it and go do it because I was told it was important. I totally missed the wink, sarcasm portion of it. when it gets over to, you know, this person's dealing only with the words with all of that extra meaning and intent totally stripped out of it. Conversely, when you go over here and you have the person that's autistic speaking, we tend to put virtually all of our meaning in the words. The fact that I don't speak in a monotone and that I actually take breaths at commas and periods is a very non-autistic trait. I studied with one of the best vocal coaches in the world to learn to do it. It's very common amongst people who are, I hate when that happens. It's very common among people who are autistic to be very, very monotone and very flat and run their words all together and not use commas and not use periods and not use, you know, just. And if you've dealt with tech people, you know exactly what I'm talking about. So they're running the words out as fast as they can run the words out to explain whatever they want to explain totally in words. And they're adding zero tonality to it. The tonality that's coming out just happens to be whatever comes out. They're not thinking about it. Their brain isn't processing it to put in the right tones, nothing. They're just, the way it comes out, it's the way it comes out. And their body language, people who have autism, flat affect is a very common trait amongst people who have autism. So if you're putting out words with no tonality and flat affect to a person that expects to get all three channels, what's going to happen? They're going to manufacture two of them for you. If I talk in a monotone, you're going to say, geez, I'm disengaged. And if I'm making, you know, funny looking faces because I'm concentrating hard and my concentrating face might look like I'm mad face, what are you going to read that as? Are you going to take the words or are you going to take and pick up these other two? Because really, that's where you get most of your information as a neurotypical anyways, is the tone of voice and the body language. Or is what they're saying really, you know, that's how I'm going to judge you. So that's a real interesting thing that happens in communication is it doesn't work like you think, where when you say words, they get to the other side exactly as you say them. They actually get stripped or they get added to. And that can totally change the discussion. What are some of the things that really trip up people that are doing interviews? Inappropriate content. And this is in when they're answering, basically. And this is saying, don't ask yes and no questions. I mean, if I ask you, I'm going to pick on you. Are you going to college?
Yes.
How much did I get out of that? I don't know where he's going. I don't know how long he's been going. I don't know if he's doing well. I don't know if he's good at it, if he's bad at it. I mean, if that was an interview question, it wouldn't have scored me very much, you know? Don't ask yes or no questions because they give you basically useless answers. I mean, say you're asking the person, do you know program XYZ? You know, it's an HR program maybe. And they say no. Well, you're going to scratch them off. They don't have the skill. But what if instead you say, have you worked with any HR programs? And they say, yeah, X, Y, and Z. And they happen to be all three competitors of the one you have. They probably have the skill, don't they? Very important. Watch out for yes and no questions because you'll often bury yourself into a hole where you didn't find anything out except you convince yourself it's the wrong person. Ask more open-ended questions. Another thing that happens very often is that when somebody's communicating back to you that's autistic is they don't recognize there's multiple levels that information comes at. If we kind of make these three circles and say this one down here is at a party, it's a social situation, and somebody says, what do you do? Well, all they want to hear is, I'm a student in college. They don't want to hear about, oh, and this is my major, and this is what I went to high school, and oh, I'm taking band, and I'm doing this. No, they just want to know, like, you know, party answer. When we move out to requirements there, you'd think of that more as being like planning. We're trying to say, okay, let's do something together, and now we have to take the little bit you told me and tell me, okay, so you're going to college. When is your summer break? When's whatever? We got to get into more details. And way out in the outside is the world that if you're in IT, it's called the code world, and if you're out, you know, in the social world we're describing, you're simply going out and you're planning to do the thing. Actually now. Well, to do the thing takes a lot more details than just at a party saying what you do. So you can see there's kind of like 3 degrees of information, I call it. And there's not fine cutoffs, but you get the general picture of there's kind of like different chunks worth you can give. And what these things on the side are showing you is if you're talking down here at the party story line, you better be telling stories. You don't want facts, it's a story. On the other hand, if you're up on the implementing side, it better be the tech or the detail of what we're doing implementing. It not only helps break it down, but often what's going to happen is you're going to be interviewing people that live in that top circle. They're the technicians. It's the workforce, the people who do the work that need to know this. And they're going to want to talk to you about it the way they think about it and do it. Unfortunately, chances are you're in about this area compared to what their job is, unless you're interviewing somebody that happens to be in your specific field for your own department. That is something that can be really helpful if you're dealing with somebody who is autistic, is to kind of say, okay, three different levels, get down here with me, please. But that is something you run into. And then another one that is a big problem is what I refer to as essentially being at different grains, different granularity. If you were to think about somebody who took physics in high school, they're going to have a model of an atom probably about like this, right? I mean, we got a nucleus, we got some electrons, they go around. If we take somebody who was a PhD in it, they're going to understand a model of it more like this, and there's going to be muons in there, and there's going to be spins and colors, and there's going to be all kinds of crap. The problem is very often when you're interviewing, you're at this level. You don't understand tech. That wasn't your job. That wasn't your business. You just know it at a real high level. But you're trying to get some interactional things out of them. Unfortunately, they're talking at the PhD level to you. So you can't really get to those interactional things you want because you can't get past their language because they're talking like an academic journal. And even worse, very often, if you speak to somebody who doesn't know as much as you do at that academic level, they're going to get mad and think you're a jerk. And thinking you're a jerk isn't a good way to get a job. So those are really three big communication issues. You know, not saying enough, talking on way too much, bring them back down, and get them at the same level of where you really want the information or the information's useless to you. Other common challenges to the autistic. One would be, what's the big game? In other words, they're not up on social stuff. I mean, if you walk in on Monday morning and go, hey man, what'd you think of the game? And they look at you like, game what, huh? Yeah, I played Dungeons and Dragons all weekend. They might not be up on social stuff. So when you have the interview, don't start out, if you know they're a neurodiverse candidate, don't start out trying to talk small talk with them because they're going to stink at it and you're going to make them uncomfortable. Better ask them about what do you enjoy? Let them talk about something they like instead. Another problem here, sensory processing disorders. Sensory processing disorders are really interesting because 80% of people who have autism have sensory processing disorders, but 80% of people with sensory processing disorders are not autistic. So in other words, the largest number of people who have sensory processing challenges are non-autistic people. And what can happen, it can work either way. It doesn't really matter in this picture. It could be that this is the autistic person and they just don't really understand controlling their volume appropriately. So they're blowing the person out of the chair because they're speaking way too loud for the situation. Conversely, you know, the person over here could be somebody who has autism, and this person isn't, you know, yelling too loud, but the sensory processing is causing them to get blown right away because it's too much for them to handle. And then third thing down here is watch out when you ask big picture questions and when you ask feel questions. In general, you're talking about people who we live in the world of details. We love details. Details are our life. It's hard to get to the big picture from the details if you live in the details. You just can't get up to that telescope. And feeling stuff, again, this isn't to say that all autistic people don't have feelings. It's very interesting when you compare male and female expressions. Females tend to be much better on the feeling portion. They just don't quite know. Autistic females have a tendency to not know what to do about it, even though they recognize the change. Autistic males, on the other hand, we tend to not even recognize the emotional change. So we just plow on. So what can you do to change all this stuff? First thing is, update your processes and look at what are the actual skills and interactional points where they're really good at. Don't look at the tribe. And by the tribe, I call that hire for fit is called the tribe. In other words, go hire somebody exactly like you so you like them. Well, that doesn't build a very good diverse team. But that's what goes on a lot of times. I mean, we all know it. We're human. We're all biased. And we know that that fit thing is, that's where a lot of traditional diversity runs into its problem is, you don't fit like I do. Change your process. Focus on the actual functional skills, not are they the same as everybody else and we'll enjoy going to the same parties we like. Autism-friendly format. Again, don't ask feeling questions. Don't ask somebody, how do you feel when you're given a task that's above your ability? Because they're going to sit there and go, But if you ask them thinking questions, if I were to give you something above your ability, how do you think you would approach it? The person could probably give you an answer how they'd go about it. They don't know how they feel about it. That's too hard to describe. But they certainly know what they do about it. Stick to asking think questions instead of feel questions. This one here is job interviews. Good. Let's do them as job auditions instead of interviews. I mean, how much can you really find out about how well somebody is going to write program code or pack boxes on the shipping line by having them sit down across the table and talk to you about it? You're not going to find out a lot. How about you give them a sample of whatever it is you do and have them do it in front of you, and you can say, yeah, they do great at it, or I don't know, we'll pass on this one. Consider putting in more job auditions, more practical pieces, and less, you know, feely kind of pieces. And then this here is just have a full process. And in that process, make it an actual structured process that you've explained to the candidate before the interview. That you've actually told them, you're going to meet with so-and-so, you're going to have a tech test, we're going to then do this, we're going to break and have you meet with the team, and then we're going to show you a tour and throw you out the front door. The person knows what they're coming into. They know what to expect. That makes them more comfortable. This one here is just saying the environment needs to be autism friendly. You just need to be aware that when you're dealing with a lot of different types of diversity, neurodiversity conditions, there are people who have environmental sensitivities. And maybe it's sensory processing disorder, maybe anything. But the three areas where they're most common is the lights. If you take and sit somebody down in a room where you've got your back to the window, the blinds are open, and you've got them on the other side of the table, well, the lights might not be the wrong type for them, but they got the sun coming straight at their eyes, and it's really hard to have a good conversation no matter who you are at that point. Or maybe you've got them in a room that doesn't have any windows and it's got fluorescent lights, and this person happens to be really bothered by that, you know, 60 hertz flicker of fluorescent lights. So just think about the environment. Lighting's a problem. Sound, noise, is another problem. You know, don't use the conference room that's right on the other side of the lunchroom. It's just not a very good place to hold an interview. It's really distracting. And then the last is smell. That's the other area where you often have a lot of sensitivities, is in smell. So again, don't go by the lunchroom, but that also means if you were interviewing, you should probably start buying laundry detergent that doesn't have heavy fragrances in it. That would be a suggestion. Cut back on the perfumes and such. Because those are things that people who have sensory processing disorder, and again, that isn't just autistic people, 80% are not autistic. Those are the kind of things that cause them to be uncomfortable, create anxiety, and then make it so they're not themselves and performing well because they're in a stressful situation. Neurodiverse, who are they and what are they like? I think we kind of covered that and beat it up. The neurodiverse is like everybody. There's no difference between neurodiverse people and neurotypical people, other than we think a little bit different. But there's as much variety in us as there is in anybody else. So you can't take any one person. I mean, who would we pick in the room to be typical of the whole room? And the answer is, nobody's typical of the whole room. Nobody's typical of all of autism. They can be anybody around you. You may not even know it. They may not even know it. Different universes. Why can't they communicate? I am convinced that we live essentially in two different universes. There's the blue universe and the yellow universe. And it's how we process and perceive. And the thing is I can't tell you things in yellow if you live in the blue universe because there's nothing for you to correspond to. But if we can push these two universes together like we do in the workplace, we get this green in the middle. I can talk about the green and you can see it from your side, and you can talk about the green and I can see it from my side. And now we can have a conversation in that green area. But as soon as you step out of it, one of us is going to lose what the other person's saying. try to create that green area and make it bigger. Get more overlap commonality between you and the other person, and there's a lot more range that you can discuss. Kind of sounds like having a relationship, doesn't it? And then this one here is, again, it's got that, you know, communication piece in it, except it throws in the other addition is there's more complication in communication than just the autism piece. There's different styles of thinking. I mean, there's word thinking, there's picture thinking, there's pattern thinking, you know, there's all different styles of thinking. So you've got a picture in your head from one of these thinking styles. You press it into words. You go through this whole thing that we already covered. On the other hand, they uncompress the words and they turn it into their thinking style. What's the chance that picture gets through? Not very good, which is why we say use pictures, right? Because pictures are worth 1,000 words. It takes about 4 minutes to do 1,000 words, and we covered the whole thing way faster than that. Getting the word out. This is probably one of the last things you really need to do is, if you're going to have a program, get the word out. Let people know about it. And there's a lot of reasons for that. One is, make sure that when you're putting out your job postings, tell people that you want diverse and neurodiverse candidates, that they're welcome. I mean, you're not doing it in a way that's discriminatory. You're just letting them know the door is open for you too. You're not saying, I only want. That would probably get you in trouble. But saying that they're welcome is opening the door, saying, hey, we understand what this is, and I bet you if you talk to us, we'll actually understand you too. So important thing is, put it right in the job post. Another thing is, make sure it's one of your company values. People need to know throughout the organization that you value diversity and neurodiversity, because if they don't get the support from the top, the answer is it doesn't happen. You know, I'll tell you from all my years of corporate, you know, whatever, nothing starts from the bottom up. If it doesn't come from the top down, it doesn't happen. And then over here is simply recognize that this is the innovative talent, and you need to get the word out to your coworkers, to the others, to managers, to everybody that, come on, you know, you could have a Steve Jobs, you could have a Bill Gates, you could have a Lincoln, there's a Daryl Hannah, I mean, there's a Robin Williams. I mean, those are all autistic people that fall under that category that could have been hired by anybody, but they weren't. And that's it, other than if you got any questions.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. We hope that you've enjoyed another episode of Life, Your Neurotypical Universe. Please, if you enjoyed this, share it with your friends. Go take their phone and subscribe them. Hey, it will help us all out. If you want to know more about neurodiversity or have any questions for me, you can reach me at my website, timgoldstein.com, where I'll be more than glad to help you as best I can to navigate through the neurotypical universe.